Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Hello everybody, Richard Martin here. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and technology has won once more. We are back online with the caller facility, so should you be inspired to call and berate me or berate President Bush or anybody else or ask a question or just make a comment in the ethers, then do so by calling 888-873-4643. Yes, the number is the same. It is 888-873-4643. Call any time, and you will be put on hold, and as soon as I can, I'll take your call, and we will discuss it. All right. Well, I thought I'd start off with just a few more people who obviously have their head in the sand, wrong again, as always. And let's start with the genius White House's top economist, Edward Lazier, who told a meeting of editors and reporters from the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires that he's confident that the U.S. economy hasn't dipped into recession, and expressed optimism that stimulus checks could bolster growth in the current quarter earlier than expected. He said the data are pretty clear that we're not in a recession. That's what he said. Well, ladies and gentlemen, so far this year we've seen a higher unemployment rate, a decline in the median price of the American home, widespread consumer pessimism, rising personal debt, a manufacturing sector in recession, and that's from the Institute for Supply Management, large commercial banks in big trouble for bad mortgage loans, the financial industry in turmoil, the threat of a bailout by Congress of foreclosed houses, a decline in sales in the auto industry, even Toyota, with no end in sight, and the Federal Reserve System in panic mode. Well, Mr. Lazar, if that isn't a recession, please would you kindly call 888-873-4643 and tell us all what is. Well, you have the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank President Charles Evans on Monday, who reiterated his belief that the U.S. economy will begin to turn around in the second half of this year. Of course, no explanation. And then we have the wise guy, U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, who has said just a few weeks ago that this was the best economy in his 36 years of business, who said a week ago that tax rebates now being issued to Americans will immediately help consumers and bolster the economy by summer. He said, "We expect that these payments will help right away, help individuals, families, and our economy. Giving people cash means that they can decide how best to use it." Well, the fact that only 40% of people said that they would actually spend the money, with the majority saying that they would actually pay down their debts or save it, and those 40% will inevitably be spending it on higher gas prices and higher food prices, unless Mr. Paulson believes that giving money away to the Middle Eastern oil interests is in fact helping consumers by bolstering the economy, I don't know what the guy's talking about. But again, Mr. Paulson is very welcome to call 888-873-4643 and take his place in the line of geniuses who is going to tell us how this economy isn't in a recession. I will take your call, Mr. Paulson. Have no fear. How about Stephen Jen, the global head of currency research at Morgan Stanley in London? We may very well have seen the bottom in the dollar. Julia Coronado, senior U.S. economist at Barclays Capital, New York. Some of the worst outcomes that people are expecting won't be realized, said she. Of course, needless to say, you know, all the economists saying these things completely missed the $8 trillion housing bubble, and most of them probably missed the $10 trillion stock bubble also. In other words, knowledge of the economy is not the strong suit of the expert economists who are telling us that the economy will be fine. Here is why they are wrong yet again. The housing market is currently in a free fall. The latest data from the Case-Shiller 20 City House Price Index shows real prices falling at an almost 30% annual rate. This rate of price decline implies a loss of almost $6 trillion of housing wealth by the end of the year. That's $80,000 for every homeowner in the country. This stunning loss of wealth has two important implications for the near-term course of the U.S. economy. First, consumption is certain to decline. For the vast majority of families, their house is their main source of wealth. Tens of millions of baby boomers are approaching retirement without a traditional pension and very little money accumulated in personal savings or a defined contribution pension. The one source of wealth that these people had been counting on in retirement, in addition to their social security, was the equity in their home. This wealth is now disappearing with the collapse of the housing bubble. As baby boomers see the price of their homes drop from $400,000 to $300,000, a typical decline, by the way, in many areas, they will suddenly find themselves with little or no equity. If they hope to have anything other than Social Security to sustain them in retirement, they will have to hugely increase their savings during their remaining working years. In many cases, the loss of equity will more directly lead to an increase in savings because it will prevent homeowners from borrowing any further against their home. At the peak of the bubble in 2006, homeowners withdrew more than $700 billion in equity from their homes. As house prices plunge, tens of millions of homeowners will no longer have any equity against which to borrow. This will leave them no choice except to cut back their consumption. Standard measures of the size of the wealth effect from housing imply that a loss of $6 trillion in wealth will reduce annual consumption by between $240 and $360 billion a year. That's between 2 and 3% of GDP. This sort of plunge in consumption would imply a severe recession or a depression. The other important effect of plunging housing prices is an inevitable surge in default rates. For some bizarre reason, many economists continue to think that the mortgage crisis was caused by adjustable rate mortgages resetting to higher interest rates. While a reset could often be a trigger event forcing families to default, the underlying problem was that house prices had fallen so that people no longer had any equity in their homes. Homeowners don't default on homes in which they have equity. They will either borrow against the equity to make their payments or they will sell the home and put money in their pocket. As house prices continue to fall, the number of homeowners with no equity will soar. Even more importantly, many homeowners will find themselves deeper underwater, making default a much more attractive mortgage. If you like your home, it may be worth paying off a $400,000 mortgage on a house that is currently worth $380,000. This sounds like a much worse deal if the mortgage is $400,000 but the home is worth $250,000, as will be the case in many of the former bubble markets. This means that the default rates will surely be heading upward in the months ahead, as will the write-off that banks will take on these mortgages. The $250 billion or so that has already been written off by the banks is just a down payment. The big hits are yet to come. Of course, the economists who most of the media rely upon to inform the public don't see any of these problems ahead, just as they didn't see any problems ahead at this time last year. But those of us who learned our grade school arithmetic know that we can look forward to serious economic and financial troubles ahead. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin here, Richard Martin's wake-up call. Just to let you know what you can do, again, you can call the station at any time between now and the next 50 minutes, and you should do so by calling 888-873-4643. Let me just repeat that once more, 888-873-4643. That will put you in touch with our engineer, who will then put you on hold. I will be informed through an IM, and then I will immediately have you ask your question as soon as I can. If you would like to write in your question, which many people have been doing these last few weeks in the absence of the call-in line, you can do that too by writing to me directly, and it your email will fall into my inbox right away, and then again I will read out your email and address your question. And the email address to which you should write is, writing please all in lowercase, rmartin@gscorporation.com. Let me repeat that once more. Remember that GS stands for Global Strategic. Global Strategic Investments is the name of the company where I work here in Miami. And the word corporation should be written out in full. And again, all in lowercase, please, ladies and gentlemen. The address is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay. Last but not least, if you should wish to call me by phone personally with your concerns or questions, please feel free to do so anytime. You can call me on my direct line, which is with me permanently, and the number is 305-357-5575. Let me repeat it once more. 305-357-5575. Okay? Call me anytime. I will be happy to take your call and to help out in whatever way I can. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, just continuing on a little bit from what I just spoke about in terms of the Pollyanna-ish views and opinions of all the people who, by the way, have a lot to gain by being so optimistic. The pernicious aspect, of course, of all this is that innocent investors who get to hear of these prognostications then, of course, receive calls from various members of the financial services industry exhorting them to buy on the basis of what the so-called experts are telling them. You know, and in a kind of story which is becoming increasingly familiar, these kind of airheaded investors are pushing up stock prices, as you can see, despite falling corporate earnings, which you may not be able to see, but I can assure you they are falling. And again, the reason for this is that is the conviction that despite mountains of evidence to the contrary, and a lot more than I have mentioned to you already today, the conviction is that the credit crisis is over, the credit bubble is returning, and, you know, all is well. But you know the result of this, as I'm sure you appreciate, those of you who are at all familiar with the stock market, is that these investors who had been holding price-earnings ratios fairly constant for 4 years have suddenly pushed them sharply upward. I mean, it's an amazing development, despite all that's going on, and despite the fact that the stock market is now somewhat appreciably weaker than it was late last year, the actual valuation of the market is higher where the price-earnings ratio in the S&P was at about 18 in the last quarter of last year. It's now up at 22 and 23, which is way above the level it was just prior to the crash of 1929. So, maybe 23 doesn't seem so high in these kind of bubble days of investor glory, but when you think that the historical average is around 14, and actually the index has been well above average since the dot-com bubble began in 1995, my contention is that following what we call the law of mean reversion, the index is going to fall to about 5 and will stay there for a number of years once this credit bubble folly bursts. Of course, now the index is rising, meaning that the fall is going to be even worse. Obviously, the reason that the PE index, the price earnings index, is rising is because corporate earnings estimates are falling. First quarter earnings estimates are falling again, the fall in earnings estimates combined with the increase in the stock prices will continue to push price earnings ratios up. They're already at the highest level since 2004. It's quite astonishing that people simply have not learnt their lesson. They simply cannot stay away from the party. The euphoria among investors is actually palpable. If you look at the sentiment figures and you see that bullish sentiment is now at multi-month highs, you realize it's going to take a lot more to break the back of these investors before they finally throw their lot in and the market goes tumbling down. When I say a lot more, I don't know what I mean by a lot more. It could be that a lot more has come into the market in the last few days and that we're at the cusp of the fall, but we are very close. People have had it too good for too long. They just can't see the wood for the trees. Reality simply hasn't hit. When you get these monthly unemployment report figures completely, floating in fantasy land, revealing that the economy had lost only 20,000 jobs in April, when economists had predicted a loss of 80,000 jobs. And again, I draw your attention to the birth-death model of corporations that I had discussed a few days ago. Systematically at Market Tops, you hear about all these mergers. And, we had the Microsoft-Yahoo merger recently, which was highly euphoric to investors because it sort of appeared to signal a return to the time when the credit bubble was being boosted by mergers and acquisitions. As you probably know, that deal collapsed a week ago, and that must have, poured some cold water on investors might have explained a little bit of the weakness that we saw earlier on. But all this euphoria, of course, is based on the widespread belief that the financial crisis is over. This view was buttressed by the report a week ago from the Bank of England, even though the conclusion was contradicted by the bank's own data. What, of course, is more shocking, which is what I mentioned to you also last week, is, that Warren Buffett has sort of joined the Kool-Aid crowd. He said to CNBC and to Bloomberg the other day, "The worst of the crisis in Wall Street is over." Well, of course, this is a big change from 2006. When he said, and I quote, "Speculators are like Cinderella at the ball having a great time, but at midnight everything turns to pumpkins and mice. As midnight approaches, the party gets to be more fun, and everyone thinks they'll get out before midnight. The problem for Cinderella is that there are no clocks on the wall." End of quote. Well, that was back in 2006 when the market was quite a bit lower than it is today, which is an even bigger change than Buffett's attitude even way back in 2003, when Buffett himself said that stocks were significantly overpriced. And that was way down from the levels of today. That was with the Dow Industrials standing at 8,000. Here we are at 12,950, 13,000. This is the greatest investor the world has ever known. As I have mentioned, I think to Frank, who's jumping at the bit waiting for my diatribe on Warren Buffett and his investment prowess, it will come, Frank, it will come. Do not fear. Not today, but this will be included in the mix, trust me. Even more startling was last week's announcement that first quarter profits of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway fell by 64% because $2 billion losses came from investments in derivative contracts, which he himself had described as weapons of financial mass destruction, or financial weapons of mass destruction, or something. In May 2007, this is what he said. He said, and I quote, "The introduction of derivatives has totally made any regulation of margin requirements a joke. I believe we may not know exactly where the danger begins and at what point it becomes a super danger. We don't know when it will end precisely, but at some point some very unpleasant things will happen in markets." Even worse, and that's the end of the quote, even worse, according to one commentator, Buffett invested in derivatives, quote, "in one of the most simplistic and historically dangerous, indeed devastating ways," end of quote. And so Warren Buffett used to have a lot of common sense. I don't know how to interpret these recent announcements, except to wonder if Buffett has completely lost his mind. We have, in August of last year, remember that depositors mobbed Countrywide Bank in California to withdraw their deposits in the face of rumors of bankruptcy. Countrywide was owned by Countrywide Financial Corp, the biggest home loan company in the nation. Countrywide had practiced the most dangerous and simplistic mortgage lending practices and was in serious trouble. In January, in a move that I called throwing good money after bad, Bank of America announced that it would acquire Countryside. Well, now Bank of America appears to be changing its mind, at least according to some rumors. According to one analyst, and I quote, "Countrywide's loan portfolio has deteriorated so rapidly that Countrywide currently has negative equity and the acquisition will be a drag on Bank of America's earnings," end of quote. Did you get those words, negative equity? That means, ladies and gentlemen, that Countrywide is now worth less than nothing. Theoretically, the stockholders should pay you to take it off their hands. So how could Countrywide be worth less than nothing? Well, let's figure out what happened. Countrywide's standard practice was to offer 100% loans to homebuyers, and now the vast majority of those homes are losing value. Therefore, the loan-to-value, or LTV, ratios are now greater than 100%. In other words, if you put together all the homes in Countrywide's entire loan portfolio into a big pile, then the total value of all those homes is smaller than the amount of money that Countrywide borrowed in order to make all those 100% loans. Putting it all together, Countrywide is worth less than nothing. On Tuesday morning, CNBC interviewed Martin Feldstein, president of the National Bureau of Economic Research, who said the following, and I quote, "I'll tell you what worries me. We saw house prices overshoot by 60% relative to costs of building and relative to rents. I worry about the possibility that they will keep falling, that they will spiral downwards in the same way that they went much too high. They could go much too low. And if that happens, then we're going to see individuals being a lot poorer, cutting back on their spending, defaulting on mortgages, and we're going to see the holders of those mortgages see those assets, their capital, being cut, and therefore their ability to make loans being cut." In other words, Feldstein is predicting a panic causing house prices to fall much further than they would have if there had never been a housing bubble. In fact, that's exactly what the data says is going to happen, as I said a week ago in my talk about home prices, which were falling by the most on record. But then Feldstein went on to say that regulators should prevent this from happening, and I quote again, "So I think that there is a role to prevent this kind of downward overshooting in house prices. Prices have to fall somewhat from where they are today, But I think the danger is we have so many loan-to-value ratios greater than 100%, and those individuals are going to have a very strong temptation to simply turn in the keys and walk away because there's nobody to negotiate with. These mortgages have been securitized to a point where they cannot simply sit across the table from their mortgage originator, from their bank, and work it out. End of quote. Well, I cannot imagine why Feldstein believes that any regulator could possibly stop this downward spiral. As far as I'm aware, no regulator has ever been able to stop a panic. So if we put it all together, what we have is giddy investors pushing price-earnings ratios up at a time when the news keeps getting worse. Well, these truly are interesting times, aren't they? All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, once again, let me give you the call-in number for your questions, of which doubtless you have some. It is 888-873-4643. Once more, it is 888-873-4643. By the way, if you do attempt to call that number and there is no response, please write me an email and let me know. Because like that, I can inform the technician that maybe there is a problem still and we need to take care of it. So if you don't get any satisfaction from that number, write to me on rmartin@gscorporation.com. Once more, the email address, all in lowercase, GS standing for Global Strategic and Corporation written out in full. Okay, once more. rmartin@gscorporation.com. Just write me a quick note, tell me you tried to get through, couldn't make it, and I will inform Eric, our engineer. Okay. Some mail, ladies and gentlemen, let's get to it. I got a note from Cliff yesterday who sent me a fascinating link to an NPR show. He says, and I'll read you his email, says, Richard, you might want to refer your listeners to this NPR show. I heard this last Saturday and was spellbound by it, as it's one of the best explanations of the subprime debacle I've ever encountered. An absolutely must-hear show. Really, really well done. Well, he is absolutely right, ladies and gentlemen. I've heard it myself, and I couldn't recommend it highly enough. I do have a link, but the best way to get it, I hope you still have your pencils and papers handy and you are ready to write, because I'm going to tell you what to do to access this show, so please prepare yourselves accordingly. What you want to do is to go to Google and write into Google the following words: the giant pool of money. Okay, that goes into your Google box, okay? I repeat again. The giant pool of money. When the titles come up on your Google page, scroll down to a title called Conceptual Trends and Current Topics. Let me repeat that again. Conceptual Trends and Current Topics. That will be your link to the article. So good luck. Enjoy it. It will go out to my listeners as the listening weekend listening. So if you are on my list, please don't panic if you didn't get this down, because you will be getting it within the next 24 hours. Okay. Let's have a look at a question from Rosemary Otika. And this is what she has to say. Hello, Richard. Saw an article that suggested commodities were the weapons of mass speculation. What do you think? I know Gary now would like to see no speculation in essential commodities. Rosemary. Thank you, Rosemary. Well, I think that the answer to that is that, first of all, I had this quick comment to make on one of Gary Nile's shows a few days ago, where he asked me the same question. And I said to him that, you know, we do need speculators, unfortunately, in the commodities markets. And I used an example, if I remember rightly, of the soybean grower who maybe has to grow soybeans right now, but he doesn't get to harvest them until, say, October. But he needs to know the price at which he is going to get for his beans in October. And the only way he can possibly do that is by selling them forward today on the futures market. So let's say that beans, which, by the way, have collapsed today, let's say that soybeans, which actually closed yesterday at 13.79 and a half, and he thinks, well, that's a nice price. I think I'll sell my beans at that price. He sells them onto the futures market. It requires a speculator to take the other side of his trade, to buy those beans, because only a speculator will be the person who will speculate that the price of beans is going to go up while taking the risk that they might fall. Now, using that example, I must tell you that today beans have lost $32.25 per bushel, which is to say they are now quoted at $13.47 and a quarter, which means that the farmer was very fortunate to have been able to sell his beans at that high price yesterday, but the speculator is now hurting very badly because he bought at that price and he's now losing. So you see, speculators do really stand an equal chance of loss as they do of gain. So in a sense, I think that's the wrong problem, Rosemary. We do need the speculators. What we really need, however, is sensible government policies which, for example, avoid using corn to produce ethanol, which is utterly pointless and very detrimental to the use of corn as food and very inefficient. Sugar, of course, being much more efficient in terms of the yield into ethanol than corn. But, of course, the U.S. government doesn't want to buy their sugar from Brazil, which has it in plentiful supply, because they'd rather give the business to the corn merchants. But the problem is that we now need the corn to eat. So that's the kind of problem that we should be focusing on, I think, Rosemary, rather than discouraging the speculators. Some countries, like India, for example, has forbidden speculation in certain commodities. I think that's the wrong approach. I don't think that's going to change anything, quite honestly. That's what's, you know, passing right now for solution, a solution to a much more serious problem. Steve Kruger, back again with two emails this week, one in which he comments on a rather caustic comment that I wrote to my email distribution list a few days ago, claiming that somebody had observed that Alan Greenspan, and I quote, has a legitimate claim to being the greatest central banker who ever lived. I didn't comment on that. I left it to my readers to decide how to deal with that one. But Steve went one step further. He wrote back, and this is what he said. Richard, after what this man has done to our monetary system, how can he be held in some kind of biblical awe? I tell you, Richard, Greenspan is in line for a Nobel Peace Prize. In America, it seems there is no nitwit deed done by a high government employee that does not get rewarded. Thank you for shining a bright light on this subject as nobody else does. Steve Kruger. Well, thanks for the observation, Steve. I don't know why nobody seems to want to stand up to the plate and deal with this man in the way he needs to be dealt with. Why they pay him hundreds of thousands of dollars to speak, you know, all around the country. It's a mystery to me, but life has frequently revealed itself as a mystery to me in more than one context. Steve, so nothing surprises me anymore. Okay, then we have his second, Steve's second email, in which he says, Richard, Uncle Ben says there are a lot of banks that can't afford to put all their poison on the balance sheet. This is what put Enron on the skids to their doom, and now it's okay to keep debt off balance sheet. We not only do not learn by our mistakes, we are encouraged to repeat them. What was a crime 10 years ago is SOP today. By the way, what is SOP? I was reading that and I was thinking, SOP, if anybody knows what that is, you might let me know because I'm really curious. SOP, I'm sure I'll kick myself when I find out what it is. It must be very obvious, but couldn't get it. Anyway, either the Enron criminals need a new trial or Uncle Ben needs his day in court. Whatever the result is, it's the taxpayer that is stuck with the bill. Steve Kruger. Yes, Steve, you are totally right. The taxpayer has been stuck with the Bear Stearns bailout, $30 billion worth, which, by the way, I'm hearing in some kind of a conspiracy theory context, that it really wasn't Bear Stearns that needed bailing out. It was actually J.P. Morgan that needed bailing out. So they sort of put it all onto the back of Bear Stearns to avoid panicking people into realizing that it was indeed J.P. Morgan that had a problem, and that it was actually very remiss of the Federal Reserve to bail them out in the first place. Well, I think it was remiss of them to bail anybody out, quite frankly, but that's just my opinion. All right. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the email. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about housing. I've spoken a lot in the past about housing, but let it really take its course. In recent weeks, we do, however, before I do that, we have an email from someone who had asked me before not to reveal her name. So I'm not going to do it. But your email came through, and it says Standard Operating Procedure, SOP. There we go, Standard Operating Procedure. Thank you very much, Susan. Appreciate the heads up on that. Standard Operating Procedure. What was a crime 10 years ago is Standard Operating Procedure today. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Susan. All right. So, and by the way, may I remind you, ladies and gentlemen, if you do write an email to me and you do want your name kept off the air, please, please, please don't forget to tell me. I know Susan had asked me to keep it off the air before. I remember that. I happen to remember it, and so I've done it again, but I don't want to make a mistake, so please be very careful to put that at the beginning of your emails. And Frank Devlin very kindly came in with the same heads up, so thank you. Thank you, both of you. Appreciate the input. All right. Overbuilt America. Well, 18.6 million housing units in the United States are unoccupied. Did you get that, ladies and gentlemen? Did you get that? 18.6 million homes in the United States are unoccupied. That's 129.4 million housing units in the United States, of which 18.6 are unoccupied. And that comes from a report released by the Census Bureau 10 days ago. That, by the way, is an increase of 1 million over the first quarter of 2007. No wonder there was a housing bust. But the number is actually a little bit misleading. 4.7 million are for seasonal use only, according to the census, unoccupied vacation homes. In other words, 4.1 million are for rent, 2.3 million are for sale, and the remaining 7.5 million, and I quote, were vacant for a variety of other reasons. The key figure is 2.3 million. That's the total number of homes that are empty and for sale. That, by the way, adds up to a vacancy rate of 2.9%, which is the highest, reports Bloomberg, since the Bureau started keeping count in 1956. This is stunning. 2.2 million homes were vacant and for sale 1 year ago. And according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development's second annual homeless assessment report to Congress, which was released in March, and I quote, the total number of homeless persons reported on a single night in January 2006 was 759,101. End of quote. Well, assuming that number bears some reasonable relation to reality, that would mean there are 24 unoccupied homes for every homeless person in the United States of America. Isn't that something? All right. Well, I'm beginning to feel like a real dumbhead now. We've got Mark Brungs comes in. Standard operating procedure equals SOP. Cheers. Well, thank you, Mark. Maybe you should just hold me off and get somebody that's more competent on the boards here. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If you thought things were bad in the housing industry in this country, wait till you hear what I have to say about housing hell in Spain and Oz. You know, otherwise known as Hell Dorado. And this was actually an article that I sent out a few days ago about the south of Spain, where I used to live as a child. When I was on vacation from school in England, I used to go out to where my mother used to live in the south of Spain next to Gibraltar, where she thought that she could get the best of both worlds. She could get her New Zealand lamb in Gib, and at the same time live out a nice, sunny, warm life in the south of Spain amongst, the Andalusians. So I know that area very, very well. So what I'm going to read you now concerns people like, my mother and other English people who are obviously the expats referred to in the article. So I read, in southern Spain, bitter expats talk about Hell Dorado, paradise that has mutated into a nightmare. Tumbling property prices, a glut of new properties still flooding onto the market, and rising Spanish interest rates are taking their toll. Added to this, illegal building practices mean that 100,000 coastal homes are now under threat of demolition. And to make matters even worse, the pound has fallen almost 12% against the euro over the last year, leading many British residents even further out of pocket. Half the 80,000 estate agents in business at the beginning of 2007 were closed by the end of the year. Demand for cement is at its lowest level in 11 years as developers stop building. And yet by the end of this year, there will be an estimated 1 million unsold properties on the Spanish market. Another 2 million lie empty. Add to that the global credit crunch and mounting Spanish interest rates, and as one real estate agent put it this week, it's like the UK situation on steroids. Thousands of Brits who saw the opportunity to make a quick buck out of Spain's property boom have had their fingers burnt. Many bought flats off plan, putting down 30% and hoping to sell before completion and make a vast profit. But flipping on, as it is known, goes horribly wrong if the property will not sell at all. The problem for thousands of British property owners has been further exacerbated by a series of scandals involving illegal business practices, building practices, which have deterred thousands more from buying. During the frenzied years of building, many local town halls apparently turned a blind eye to planning regulations or even took bribes to grant building licenses to thousands of homes that were constructed on protected land. Recent crackdowns by regional and national governments have led to the arrest of dozens of planning officials, and thousands of homes are now under threat. Earlier this year, that threat became a reality for Len and Helen Pryor, who sold their family home in Berkshire and built a £350,000 retirement villa in the seaside town of Vera in Almeria 5 years ago. From the start, they did everything by the book, employing a reputable lawyer and obtaining a business license from Vera Town Hall before the property was built. What they didn't know was that behind the scenes, the regional government in Seville had already warned town hall planners that developments should not go ahead because it entailed urbanization of rustic land. In January, the 64-year-old's house was demolished in front of them after a dramatic standoff during which Mr. Pryor, who has a heart condition, collapsed and was taken to hospital. 4 months on, and the pensioners are living like gypsies on the land they still own. "We have nowhere else to go," says Mrs. Pryor. Well, I think it's time to read a quote from the great novel of Leo Tolstoy called War and Peace. "With the enemy's approach to Moscow, the Moscovites' view of their situation did not grow more serious, but on the contrary, became even more frivolous, as always happens with people who see a great danger approaching. At the approach of danger, there are always two voices that speak with equal power in the human soul. One, very reasonably, tells a man to consider the nature of the danger and the means of escaping it. The other, still more reasonably, says that it is too depressing and painful to think of the danger, since it is not in man's power to foresee everything and avert the general course of events, and it is therefore better to disregard what is painful till it comes, and to think about what is pleasant." Now, it sort of reminds one of what happened on the Titanic shortly before the disaster, where people were still dancing in the ballroom, and the band was still playing, and the boat was already sinking. In fact, the band played on right up until the very end, until the water engulfed their bodies. Well, it really is as bad as that, ladies and gentlemen. The financial and economic world is closing in on you and me and everyone as we speak. Nobody wants to broach it. Nobody wants to face it. Nobody wants to take measures to protect themselves. What I've read you today about people who still think things are fine is endemic. It's exactly what you would expect at a time like this. It happened in the 1920s and early 30s, and it happened again in the 90s. It happened in the 70s, actually, with the oil problem. But now this is the culmination of everything that has happened since the 30s. And people are more ignorant and more full of illusion than they ever were. And it's really very scary to watch it. And I don't expect you, you know, to take out a gun at this point and pull it on yourselves, but I will tell you that it is very important that if you wish to maintain a sense of balance in your lives, that you do understand the nature of what is going on, and you do face it, and you take measures accordingly. And I assure you, you will be streets ahead of your friends and acquaintances when the terrible time comes, because it is getting closer and closer. Well, let's just talk a little bit more about the what I call the Financial Patriot Act that I have mentioned. And there was a recent article in Bloomberg which described Bernanke's recent rate cuts, which were followed by the release on March the 31st of a sweeping proposal by U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson to revamp government supervision and regulation of the financial system. Paulson endorsed the Fed's move to stabilize the economy and proposed the central bank be given a permanently expanded role as watchdog over the entire financial system, including commercial and investment banks, insurance companies, hedge funds, and mutual funds. And I quote, "The Fed would have the authority to go wherever in the system it thinks it needs to go for a deeper look to preserve stability." At a press briefing in Miami on April the 7th, Paulson said the plan, which would abolish the Securities and Exchange Commission, may take several years to implement, and the Democrats who control Congress say no quick action is likely. Even so, Bernanke's Fed has already grabbed some of the power the Treasury proposes to give it by inserting itself into back offices of the investment banks. And I quote, "Since we began lending to dealers, including the remaining investment banks, we have put examiners on the ground in those firms, and we've established off-site teams that coordinate with them." End of quote. And that was Bernanke to Congress's Joint Economic Committee in testimony on April the 2nd. So you really can see that already the heavy hand of Big Brother is on top of us. And I assure you, this is not what Americans want to see. This is not the America that Americans refer to when they call this country the greatest country on earth. And it's just one more notch in the police state, which is coming around to envelop us all in the years to come. Very, very scary, actually. Even the former Fed Vice Chairman Alan Blinder says that Bernanke's actions are justified. He says that Paulson and Bush have done little to address the mortgage crisis. The Fed has been extremely creative and is fighting this war almost exclusively by itself. Then comes along Paul Volcker, who we can all depend on to pull us back into a sense of reality, who says, the Bernanke Fed may have already seized too much power and has abandoned historical principles. And I quote, "The Federal Reserve has judged it necessary to take actions that extend to the very edge of its lawful and implied powers." Volcker, 80, told the Economic Club of New York on April the 8th. "A direct transfer of mortgage and mortgage-backed securities of questionable pedigree from an investment bank to the Federal Reserve seems to test the time-honored central bank mantra in times of crisis. Lend freely at high rates against good collateral. It tests it to the point of no return." Well, Bernanke, for his part, says the gravity of the crisis is extraordinary. Until the beginning of this year, he had looked for consensus among his fellow Fed governors, a departure from the chairman-dominated regime of Greenspan, says Gramley. Then, in a January 10th speech, he laid out a more dour view of the country's economic prospects and promised to lower interest rates to address the unfolding credit crisis. The speech signaled that Bernanke was shaping policy rather than following the view of the group, Gramley says. I quote, "That was when Bernanke realized the idea of letting a consensus develop sounded good, but in times like we were going through now, would no longer be effective. He put his foot down. That is what we have been seeing since then." End of quote. Alan Meltzer, a Fed historian and economics professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, agrees that the Bernanke is swatting a fly with a sledgehammer. Quote, "In monetary policy, he has not been good." Meltzer, who, like Volcker, is also 80 years old, says, "It is a silly policy designed to head off a recession that may come, but hasn't come yet." Meltzer says the Fed, by ignoring the inflationary potential in its latest rate cuts, is creating the possibility of negative real interest rates. He also says the Fed should never take credit risks, especially to save floundering banks. And I quote, "We can't have a system that continues to work well if bankers make the profits and the public, the taxpayers, take the losses. That is not a viable system." End of quote. Meltzer says Paulson's plan for expanded Fed oversight of its financial industry is both overreaching and impractical. Quote, "It's hard to see how the Fed is going to do it," he says. "The Fed's record of anticipating and heading off crises is poor. Now they're going to go out and examine investment bank portfolios? Most of the people who are buying and selling this stuff don't fully understand it. How is some Fed auditor going to figure it out?" Well, you know, these people are basically saying what I'm saying, but I think they probably haven't caught on to it yet, ladies and gentlemen. I don't think they quite get it. This is not just a benign government institution trying to help investors and other people caught up in the financial snare sort themselves out. This is the hand of Big Brother. This is the Homeland Security people coming in through people in another department known as the Federal Reserve. And it's very frightening. It's what I told you. It's the what the trying to do is to circumscribe your freedoms yet more and more until finally you end up without any and without even understanding that you have ended up without any. And by that time, it's too late. Let's just finish with a few statistics here from the latest LA Times Bloomberg poll. Nearly 2 out of 5 people say the state of their personal finances is fairly shaky or very shaky. And for the first time since 1993, the percentage of people who said their finances were very or fairly secure fell below 60% to 57%. Anything below 60% is sort of like a warning sign of what's coming next, the poll director Susan Pinkus said. It paints the picture of a very grim, weakened economy that is affecting how people are going to spend. More than 3/4 of those polled said that they thought the economy had fallen into a recession and that the country was, quote, seriously off on the wrong track. 1/2 of those polled said 2008 would be a below average year for the stock market, and 56% of registered voters said the economy should be the top priority for the presidential campaign, a shift from December, when the majority said Iraq should be the candidate's focus. Money worries plague Americans across the financial spectrum. Of those making between $60,000 and $100,000 a year, 26% describe their finances as shaky. 10% of those making more than $100,000, including Fleckenstein, used the same terminology. And Fleckenstein was an example of somebody that lives comfortably in retirement, whose higher food and energy costs have prompted him to trade down from a big American car to a small Honda and to cancel his plans for a European vacation. And he says, I just bought gasoline at $3.96, and milk is about off the chart. It isn't easy today, and he indicates that he had an income of more than $100,000 a year. 61% of whites and 54% of other ethnic groups polled said their personal economic situation was secure. Just 39% of African Americans described their finances in positive terms. More than 1/2 of African Americans polled, 53%, said their finances were shaky. 34% of whites and 42% of other ethnic groups polled expressed similar concerns. The Times Bloomberg poll has a margin sampling error of 3 percentage points. 2 out of 5 Americans who have credit card debt said it was more than it was 5 years ago, with 22% saying they owed much more on their cards. 10% of credit card holders said they owed more than $7,000 on their credit cards. 11% said they owed more than $10,000. Many of those surveyed do not anticipate their debt load growing lighter in the year ahead. 15% of respondents said they expected to have more debt in the coming year, and nearly 1 in 10 Americans said they also expected to have lower assets. But still, despite their worries about the housing market, many of those polled haven't given up on the American dream of owning real estate. When asked where they would invest a hypothetical $1 million, 1/4 of those polled said that they would buy real estate more than in any other category. I mean, the mind boggles, ladies and gentlemen. They just can't stay away. Hope that doesn't include any one of you. Well, here we are at the end of time, and hopefully I will see you all here back again on Monday at 1 p.m. This is Richard Martin wishing you a very relaxing weekend, saying bye-bye for now.